another one of the sessions in the business and society track, Leaders Driving Change, Business and Innovation. We are pleased this morning to welcome our moderator, David Kirkpatrick, who's a technology journalist and senior editor at Fortune Magazine, who really specializes in the computer and tech industries. And it's my pleasure to turn it over to him.
Well, thank you so much. And of course, that being what I do has very little directly to do with the subject of the panel, but that's okay. I write about business, just I focus on the technology piece, and that I guess that is really relevant because we have sort of a dual theme today, and the theme is driving social change. What's the relationship between business and social change, and what kind of a role does innovation play in that? And so we're going to try to intertwine those two themes. But, you know, in sort of an uber sense, I think that this whole question of what is doing well by doing good is one of our main themes. And also, what is the responsibility of the company in modern society? And specifically, how has it changed in recent years, given something that I write about, the internet, and all the changes that that's brought about in terms of integrating more voices into the dialogue, and also just the global situation which we now find ourselves in, particularly regarding environmental change. Does that give corporations more responsibility, and in what ways? So we are really lucky to have representatives of some of the world's most innovative, largest, and most interesting companies on the panel. Just starting from your right and next to me, Jim Turley is the CEO of Ernst & Young. Then next to him is Les Dock. Did I pronounce that right? Who is, what's your exact title? He's with Walmart, but give me your exact title.
Executive Vice President of Government Affairs and Corporate Relations.
So you're the PR guy, but you do more than that.
I try to. Yeah. Since you can only have good PR if you actually have good substance.
He's extremely articulate, I can tell you that. Next to him is a longtime friend of mine, Padmasree Warrior, who's the Chief Technology Officer at Motorola, who had a session here many of you may have seen the other day. And finally, Diane Ogilvie, who is the General Counsel and CEO, Chief Environmental Officer of Toyota of America. And you know what I thought maybe the way to start, Diane, could I start with you? I want to ask you to just tell us a little bit about how, and the reason I'm starting this way, just to back up, is when some of us were preparing in advance for this, we were talking about how the auto industry in the United States has fought an increase in the CAFE standards. And what does that mean? You know, and we many of us heard Tom Friedman the other day rather much railing against Congress and the auto industry for not doing more to increase auto efficiency and for celebrating the fact that, I think as he put it, by 2020, the newly enacted legislation will require the U.S. auto industry to be at the level that Europe is at today. And why can't we do a lot better than that? And why is it that the auto industry has fought that? And then we have the contrary example, which is Toyota, whose entire image has been transformed by, and certainly a large part of its business, revenue, and profit has been improved by its early awareness of the need to be more environmentally responsible. So I was wondering if you could just tell us how that happened, Diane.
Well, I can talk a little bit about it. Beginning in the late 80s, early 90s, a couple of the visionary leaders at Toyota, A.G. Toyota and Dr. Toyota, began raising questions at the Toyota board around whether Toyota should continue to make automobiles, whether that was going to be a viable business in the 21st century, and whether or not what appeared to be a collision course between automobiles and the environment was going to continue, and whether there was any way around that. And I won't go into all the details because, quite frankly, I don't know all the details. But what came out of that was a decision to go forward. But it was also a decision to go forward under a new charter, what we call the Earth Charter. It was adopted in 1992. And it provides that each and every part of Toyota must use its maximum efforts to minimize the imprint of the company on the environment and to grow in harmony with the environment. Now, early on, particularly Dr. Toyota turned that immediately into a challenge for the engineering departments at Toyota. And he said, he first went to them and said, I want you to build a car for the 21st century that's going to meet all the requirements of what people need, but I want it to have the very best emissions performance in the world, and I want it to have 50% fuel economy improvement over a comparably sized vehicle. About 2 years, he put a group of engineers, locked him up in a facility for a while, and they were, oh, what are we going to do? About a year later, he went back and said, I've been thinking about it. I want 100% improvement. Well, 1997 in Japan, out came the Prius with 100% improvement and the best smog emissions performance in the industry. So that's really how it got started. The big challenge for us has not been that. It has been taking that Earth Charter and turning it into concrete plans and actions for every person in Toyota worldwide.
But why do you think it is that Toyota, that Dr. Toyota, what is it that, was it Japanese culture, is it his unique personality that led him so early to see that there would be a need for such a thing?
The doctor's always been an incredible visionary. And I think people who were paying attention to what was going on in the late 80s, early 90s, could see the problem coming. So I think then it was merely a question of, okay, how do we react to that problem? Because it was very clear that oil supplies were going to be diminishing over time, that the impact of the automobile on the world had not been overwhelmingly positive. I mean, the core value at Toyota is kind of an odd thing. The core value is make useful things. Now, we always joke that, and they just think it's too bad they have to sell them. But because it's an engineering company, it's a production company, and that's really what it's about. So taking those environmental challenges and turning them into engineering challenges is very second nature to what they do every day.
Well, you know, but the question still arises, considering how many other auto industries there are that did not have that revelation, which you think was obvious at the time. Honda, of course, was on a similar track. But aside from Toyota and Honda, really, none of the other companies were anywhere near that realization at the time. But one thing that strikes me when you say that, and I confess I hadn't heard that was Toyota's mission before, but I write about technology, and it's quite interesting to pair that with Google, where really the whole ethos of the internet industry today is basically make something that users can use and figure out how to make money later. And that is explicitly the way Google talks about it internally, and they have the luxury of doing so, you might argue. But, you know, it's so interesting that a manufacturing industrial company has been able to function that way and then ends up being arguably, clearly, the most successful company in its industry. So I don't know. Pedmasri, pick up on that. Tell me, how does Motorola think of these issues and try to analogize it to Toyota to the degree you can?
I think the analogy, I mean, our core value, one of the core values that Motorola has is very similar. We call it solving relevant problems. I think if you figure out how to solve problems that consumers face across the globe, it will ultimately turn out to be good business. And I think, you know, there is something flawed I think we were talking about this earlier, in saying just do things because it feels like that's the right thing to do. An example I can cite is we have a strategy that we call connecting the unconnected. If you look at the world today, there's roughly 6.6 billion people. It's roughly the population of the planet today. 2.9 billion cell phones in the world. Roughly half the planet uses a mobile technology in some way or another to connect. There's a lot of regions in the world, there is no electricity, there is no power. So it becomes very expensive to connect these regions in any way. But people there have a basic desire to connect. So one of the things that we did is in Namibia, and I talked about this yesterday, and in Uganda, there is no electric grid connection to many regions. So we went there and we said, okay, how do we solve this problem? Can we use solar energy and wind energy to create GSM cellular base stations? And we just installed, and we are conducting a trial in a small village outside the capital city of Namibia. This place is called Durdabis, and it's the world's first cellular base station that runs on solar and wind power. and that provides now connectivity to that village. And you can argue we're not making, obviously, the highest percentage of margins are not coming from that particular business. But the reason we are doing that is if you look at the population and look at where the growth is going to come from in the industry, half of the growth in our industry is going to come from developing countries, because that's where people want the connectivity. They're willing to pay for that connectivity. Obviously, the kinds of solutions there are going to be very different than what you would deploy in a Korea or a Japan type of market where there is broadband penetration across the country. So I think fundamentally the responsibility that corporations have, going back to what role do they play, I think it comes back to innovating to solve real problems that exist in the world and figuring out how to make money off it, because ultimately you will make. I mean, companies are here to make, for-profit companies are here to be in business, and you know that is obviously the motivation that drives all of us. But how you innovate to solve relevant problems, I think, is very key in affecting change, whether it's societal change or environmental change.
Okay, I want to come back to some of those things, but let's hear from Les first. Give us the Walmart point of view. I mean, Walmart has been the subject of a lot of criticism and has worked hard to explain why it does believe itself to have a positive role in society, and you've been hugely involved in that. What's the conclusion there?
Well, I think what I'd like to do today is to sort of focus on the work we've been doing about sustainability and maybe use that as an example of this previous conversation. About after Katrina, where the company found itself stepping in a really significant way and felt very good about the contribution it made kind of spontaneously in the aftermath of Katrina, the company began to say to itself, well, you know, how can we be that kind of company all the time? How do we take advantage of our size and scope and begin to have a clearly positive footprint in the world beyond what we do day to day as a business? And quickly, the company came to look at sustainability as a place where we could do that. And I think how we came to why that is important, I hope helpful to other companies looking at it, because we first tried to say, where is the place we can make the greatest contribution? And so we looked at ourselves and what we do, and we began with a mission, which is to save people money so they can live better. But then we began to look at our business model and our assets. So our business model is also fairly simple. It's to arrive at everyday low costs, to basically pass those on to the consumer in everyday low prices. And then we looked at our customer and began to think about them in sustainability. And that's where we found some very interesting things. You know, the average Walmart customer is about a $40,000 a year average family income. 20% of them don't have bank accounts. And frankly, they don't care about sustainability. They have much more important issues to them in their lives. Because for them, they really have to make every dollar, every peso count. And spending money on sustainable products is frankly not something that is important to them in their lives. And so what we decided is that what we needed to do was to apply that business model into sustainability, because we felt that the Walmart customer shouldn't have to choose between a product they can afford and a product that they would allow them and their children to lead a more sustainable life. That there was a lot of, in a sense, economic discrimination out there already, and this was another area where they were about to face limited choices. And we thought that we could apply our business model and our relationship with the customer to help them do that.
Because of your scale, basically?
Because of our scale and because of our ability to work the supply chain. So, and that's when we looked, and I think as every company does, when it sets out a goal is then to look at its assets. And so, what are the touch points you have in society? And for us, they're the 130 million Americans who visit the store every week. They are the 2 million people who work for us, and they are the 60,000 suppliers who supply us. And so as we try to look at what we could do about sustainability, we try to look at how we could touch all of those places, plus the 4,000 stores that we own and operate. And so we began, I think, like all businesses do, by setting out some goals. And what was important to us, and I think for any business who does this in any area, is to first have an aspirational goal, but also to have very clear metrics that you can meet. So we set ourselves very clear metrics, for example, on our stores to make them 30% more energy efficient, to reduce their greenhouse gases by 20%, and then went about doing that. And I'll just mention one or two other things that I think are important kind of as principles as others look at this. The first thing we decided to do is to be very bottoms up and inclusive. And that was hard for Walmart because it's a company that hasn't always opened itself up to talk to its stakeholders. But we learned by opening ourselves up to talk to the NGO community, particularly about these kinds of issues, that it made us a better company. And it made them better, ultimately better NGOs. So we've put together 14 what we call them sustainable value networks, jewelry, lumber, fish, cotton, we're textiles, where we have NGOs, Walmart associates, and our suppliers working together. And so we've been able to really try and do this very inclusively, to do it very bottoms up. And just one last point, which I think is very important for us, is to try and make sustainability sustainable. Because when you do have a business model like ours that's everyday low cost, what you don't want to do is to put your sustainability initiatives kind of at the peril of changing economics. So what we've required all of the folks who run our networks to do is to basically promise clear bottom line returns from what they do. And we've built those bottom line returns into what we call the Form 1, which is the basic P&L to run the business. And so what we've tried to do is to make sustainability sustainable at Walmart so that even in tough times, none of our sustainability initiatives will get cut because they're so deeply embedded in the economics of the business. And we also want to make sustainability sustainable for our customer so that they don't have to make these hard choices between these two different kinds of products. So ultimately, that's our goal, to make use innovation and to use our touch points to make sustainability sustainable at Walmart, and also to give our customers the opportunity to make sustainability sustainable in their daily purchasing lives.
Well, in some ways, what I hear you saying is that the pressure that Walmart received ended up helping it make better business decisions, in a sense, because Walmart was under criticism for healthcare for its employees, for locking janitors in, for other things. And that was before Katrina, right? You knew you were on, but then you said you had that amazing opportunity to show how much you could do, and you got a lot of goodwill as a result. And you, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong in this chronology. And then what I think then is, it was, you told me on the phone, now you're doing things like putting in the solar power mm-hmm. in the stores, which you amazed me by saying, "Will you have 22 stores that are all solar?" No.
We have 22 stores that will be mostly solar in California and Hawaii, so it'll be somewhere in the top five solar installations.
So you said you'll be profitable day one for having done
yeah.
that?
I mean, I think one of the amazing things we've learned about sustainability, and I go through some of the, at some point in this, if people want some of the specific things we've done, but everything that we've done in our stores to reduce our electricity, we're the largest private user of electricity in America, so to reduce make our stores 30% more efficient, one of the things we've done is to put solar panels on the top of 22 stores. We're in the process of it. And we will save money on electricity on the first day those are operational. And those solar panels, in this case, are owned by the solar company. We just pay for the electricity. But today, given both the tax breaks that the solar companies have that we don't, and what's happening in technology, we can now buy solar cheaper than the electricity we buy off the grid.
But do you accept the point that in some ways, that it was a good thing that Walmart got the pressure it has gotten and continues to get, frankly?
I think change comes from many places, and I think the scrutiny that we have ultimately makes us a better company. Hmm. We obviously don't agree with a lot of the criticism. We think some of the fundamental things we do, which is to save people money and to bring jobs and to underserved areas where they don't have them, are quite beneficial to the economic development and to job creation in this country. But we also agree that the scrutiny has made us a better company and will continue to make us a better company.
Okay, so Jim, you know, you're, unlike the other three companies on the panel, not in the direct consumer business. You're more in the business of helping other
yep.
companies do their work better. And just, it's interesting, you know, historically there has been a very strong strand of economic theory and opinion that the most socially responsible thing that a company can do is be responsive to its customers, make money, because if you're making money, it must mean somebody wants to buy what you make, right? So, is there a degree to which companies today need to go beyond that, or is that sufficient?
No, I think there definitely is a need for companies to go beyond that. And it's interesting that, you know, the broad level topic of today is leadership driving change, and then also driving change for sort of societal good. I had the pleasure of becoming CEO of an accounting firm about 4 months before Enron happened. So we've driven a lot of change through our organization.
A little pressure there too.
You know, and actually for the positive, you know, big change around our people culture, big change around our quality culture, you know, change getting used to being a regulated business, change to be a truly global business. So a lot of that change. I think the most interesting thing relative to your topic is over the last few years, I and others have been focusing more on looking externally and inward. And I don't mean externally inward as meaning from the marketplace in, because that was all about growth. That's what we were about in the 90s. but instead looking at the impact that we have on organizations and people that we touch, and really defining ourselves internally for our 120,000 people based upon the impact that we have. And we've sort of focused that in three buckets: the impact we have on the people we come into contact with, because we truly help build many of the great people in the country and the world. We work and serve an enormous number of outstanding organizations, as you've said, but we also make deep contributions to the communities in which we live and work. And so when, Les, you said figuring out where you could make the greatest contribution, I think was how you said it, you know, we're looking at that. How can we take things that we are world class in and use that to benefit these three groups, if you will, that we have impact on? We're known internally, we're known by others looking at us as being one of the best learning and development organizations in the world. Not one of the top in the Big Four, but one of the best in the corporate world. So we're committing ourselves now to take that skill and that competency and figure out how can we benefit either, you know, the previous panel we talked about, K-12 education in this country. How can we benefit others in financial literacy? You know, both taking our learning and developmental skills and also our financial literacy, because we have a belief that financial literacy is a barrier to advancement of people all around the world. How can we take our expertise in entrepreneurship, another core skill that Ernst & Young has, and use that to build entrepreneurs around the globe, not just in Silicon Valley? That's done very well without our direct help. But how can we help drive entrepreneurship in China, in Russia, in India, in places around the world? And then how can we take our focus on governance and also use that to help some of these developing markets, you know, strengthen their own adoption of global standards and transparency and whatnot? So in a different kind of way, not in as much a product focus, we're trying to take the things that we're good at and figure out how to have the biggest positive impact on the world around us. That's, you know, notwithstanding the internal things we're doing around procurement, around, you know, encouraging our people, around, you know, being, if you will, as green as we can be. But it's really how we're beginning to think, not just domestically, but globally.
If I could just add to that, I think it's a very important point that I've learned in my brief tenure is that, you know, really the companies, if you when you're looking at where you can make the greatest contribution, you want to look first at kind of what you're good at.
That's right.
Because that's where the leverage is. You know, so that, you know, for example, Walmart and healthcare, you know, we know that what we're good at is driving price out of the system. So when we think of what we can do with healthcare, we think of opening clinics in our stores where people can get healthcare for much less cost than they would pay at an emergency room, and we can still make money. When we look at what we can do in healthcare, we say to ourselves, you know, can we reduce the price of generic prescriptions to $4 so that people can save money? The system can save money, and we can still make money. And so I think companies ultimately, they recognize they have to both sell a great product, they also have to be socially responsible and address these stakeholders. But where you get the greatest leverage is when you figure out what you're good at, what makes your people the most proud, and then try and bring that together with a social need. And that's where you get great results.
And you really added it at the end when you said the people, because to me it's what organizationally you're good at and what your people really rally behind. We're a business unlike, you know, the others here. We have no assets, zero assets that don't go home at night. And so we don't have patents, we don't have stores, we don't have, you know, plants and machinery equipment. Every one of our assets goes home every night. We've got to be the kind of place that they want to come back to the next day. And so the only way to achieve that, I think, is to really not just do our work well, but have a sense of public purpose towards investors in our business and towards the world as a whole that they can rally around.
I think I just want to simplify things. I think we all come from big corporations, and maybe we are overcomplicating this thing. I think to me, that the question we're trying to address is very simple, and I think we have to look at what motivates us, right? What motivates companies to change, or why would we want to change society, et cetera? So simply, I think there are two things. One is the first thing that motivates us or acts as stimulus or impetus is whether it's pressure that says, you know, PR pressure or pressure from customers and stakeholders, or the market dynamics have changed. When the cell phone was invented, it was a business user. Now it's a consumer product. It's the developing market that, so it's forcing us to innovate differently, right? So the market has changed. There's something that has changed in the market dynamics. And the third, so I think that is a very, that impetus is a very deliberate, opportunistic motivation for companies to change the way they innovate, the reach that they have. The second thing is the stakeholders. I mean, global companies typically touch many different, you touch the government. I'm looking at Michael Powell and Colin Powell sitting here. Michael was the FCC chairman, and we did a lot of work too. We have to do a lot of work to make sure that we are influencing the regulation to be the right way, not just in the United States, but in all the different countries that we do business in. So I think that is a different kind of motivation, and you know, along with that goes the global citizenship that companies have that are global. We're in every different country across the planet, and we have employees in many different parts of the world. So I think the two simple things that motivate private sector to influence society is, first is somewhat a selfish motivation. The market has changed. To stay in business, you're forced to innovate differently. The second thing is, as a big company, you have many different touch points, whether your assets are people that are going home, or whether it is, you know, people that have low income that are coming to buy across the world, so you have a great channel, or whether are selling different products. I think that is what drives us. And so as a result of that, I think we have to think about when that is driving companies to impact society, how do you make sure that drive is not necessarily stifled by bureaucracy and in other things that tend to happen in big companies, to be really honest. I think when you have a big company, you tend to put the advantage that Google had was it started as a very small company, so they could have a very idealistic goal, which turned out to be a great business model. I think the difficulty that big companies have is that there's a lot of process that's there, and sometimes you have to break the process to create something that's different, mm-hmm. which I think presents a big challenge. I mean, when you go and argue in front of your board, you know, you're debating the question of, is this company going to stay in business, is it good business or not, or you go to argue to build a solar-powered base station that's not going to make 50% margin the first day, it's a very difficult argument to make. You have to swim upstream, and you know that takes a lot of guts from leaders who are passionate, who can stand up and argue why this makes sense. And you can't just stand in front of your board in Wall Street and say, "Gee, this is, you know, this is good for humanity." Ultimately, it has to be good business. That takes a lot of guts and courage, I think. And you
well,
can't...
an analytical understanding to draw the connections.
Right, exactly, yeah. And a lot of passion, a lot of you know compelling ways of selling it to different stakeholders, because you have to sell your board, you have to sell your You have to sell the press, you have to you know, have good PR, and you have to do all those things. And I think sometimes we underestimate the difficulty of doing that.
You know, I think your two are very good reasons. I'm going to be a little bit unpopular, perhaps, and this is not going to come out right when I say it, I'm sure. But
that's the kind of thing I like.
There may be a third one here that I was talking with the CEO this morning, and the third one might actually be corporate ego. And by that, you know, the breakfast discussion.
The way of saying that is the brand image.
No, it's beyond brand image, because this person was saying that some of the challenges that society and the world are dealing with are so complex that this person I was talking with, frankly, did not feel that the governments were up to solving them on their own, and that it was. You know, in some ways, if not the corporate community contributing to the solution, then the problem may not get solved. And so that's where I'm coming at it from, sort of an ego that perhaps, you know, we all think we are, you know, reasonably intelligent people. But it was a very interesting discussion this morning that I was in about, you know, government's ability or inability by themselves to solve some of the most complex problems.
That's not such a radical statement.
No, I mean, I know.
If you look at the three companies over here, all three of which are truly global, you know, and
you don't count us as global?
Well, you are. I don't, you know, you're behind the scenes. Yeah, you're global. Okay,
I was saying, we're in 140 countries.
Okay, four. All the four.
How many countries
are
you in?
13.
Okay.
But the fact is, businesses, large companies are typically managing their globalness better than any government at the moment. So it makes sense that this is really a global imperative. It's a social imperative that if companies can't figure out how to take advantage of their global scale, to their own benefit and also to the benefit of humanity, we got a big problem because business dominates global society. That's just the fact, for better or for worse.
Because the long-term benefit of humanity will also benefit the four organizations sitting at this table.
Of course it will.
That's got to be the value driver.
And I think it's both parts of this, what you said, which is, looking from our, at least the Walmart experiences, first, we certainly see, and I think anyone does, that the big issues that face the world, and we've talked about this elsewhere these last few days, poverty alleviation, healthcare, particularly in the United States, other countries have solved it better, sustainability. If you looked at Capitol, if you waited for Capitol Hill or the White House to solve these problems, we'd be back for many, many years in the same place. And one thing that business people are used to is trying to get something done. Yeah. And so you get frustrated. You also say to yourself, we have an obligation. And you put that together and you say, we can help, we can make a real difference in sustainability. We have an opportunity, not only an obligation, but an opportunity to lead. We make a difference. And if we sit here and do nothing, these problems are just going to stay stuck. And if there's one thing business people don't like are things that are just kind of stuck.
Well, there's another thing I want to layer over this, and we can begin to get to the audience questions and comments pretty quickly, but it does go to the reason why maybe I'm not the wrong person to moderate this. I cover the internet, and the internet has created this public voice that is much louder than it's ever been before. And you talk about, Enron changing your business, and we were talking before about how public opinion and a lot of public opinion has changed Walmart. I think that the facility for that having happened is a fundamentally new environment, where in the voice of the consumer, of the public, really independent of government, has become much more powerful. And what I hear, the interesting thing that I'm hearing almost every company here saying, is that that has been to the benefit of you all. And the one exception possibly is Toyota, where the only company, at least at the beginning of your story, that was still being led by its visionary founder, right, who had that sort of unilateral power to dictate this would happen, and people would respect it.
Well, don't mistake me to say, our visionary leader, first of all, he wasn't the founder, he's
the son of the
second
founder.
Son of the founder.
Okay, sorry, but he's got the name.
But he doesn't have control. He has the same problem she's talking about. He's talking to his board. You basically have to continue to sell it. But one of the things I think that makes Toyota unique is that the decision-making process is dispersed. We don't have we had a vision, but the translation of that into something is not a hierarchical thing. It is about energizing every employee of the company toward that end.
Right.
And it is that energy which is where we call it Kaizen, the continuous improvement. There is no best, only better. So that every person on the line building a car is empowered to stop the line to make the car right before it leaves that station. So we translate that into every single person in the company has an obligation to figure out how we're going to live up to this Earth Charter. Yeah. And that has produced some extraordinary results, which have been, quite frankly, very good for the bottom line.
Like, give us an example.
My favorite example is a young woman who is in the logistics department. And she was responsible for buying some new equipment to unload rail cars at remote locations like in Arizona and New Mexico. And she was very interested in this environmental initiative. And so she says to herself, as she tells me, I was thinking, we're going to put that hydraulic equipment out there, and it's going to have oil in it. And what if that breaks? And that oil is just going to go everywhere. And then that'll be our fault. And she said, so she went to her, she just picked up the phone, called the vendor, and said, why don't you put vegetable oil in those things? And they said, oh, yeah, you can. Well, just look into it. Next thing you know, we buy all vegetable oil hydraulics, and that's all that company makes now. So that's the kind of
like
thing.
That's kind of like a Walmart effect, yeah.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing, though, that wouldn't have happened. Nobody told her to do that. No one said, you should think about how to make, she's thinking, my job is to make this better. So we could have diked all those things. We could have built places to contain them. But there was a better solution, and she thought of it. So we always think that the people who know best are the people who are closest to the problem.
I think it's, to get this optimally done, it needs to have leadership at all levels. And it doesn't need to have leadership from the person who sits in Jim's chair because, for example, at Walmart, we get together every quarter for a sustainability meeting, put all the 800 people who kind of work on this either as a big hobby or day-to-day in the auditorium, the CEO and all the senior staff is there. And it's very clear that the CEO cares deeply about this. And so, if we may be 20% of Procter & Gamble's worldwide business, so if the CEO of Procter & Gamble comes to visit Bentonville and he knows what our CEO cares about, what does he have in his briefcase? He has the latest, newest, lightest weight packaging that they're now using, put Tide in, because he knows that's what we care about. So you get a very virtuous circle. So I think you need to have this, when the CEO is passionate about it, that makes a difference. When you be sure that everybody who works for you is involved in it, that makes a difference. And if you want to get the most out of the system, you need all of these cylinders kind of, integrating and working together. And that's where you really begin to make this thing take off.
I don't know. I have a very different viewpoint. I think maybe I disagree to some extent. I think the CEO is there, but I don't think it's his or her job to drive innovation in companies. I think what we find is we have 60,000 employees worldwide. We are a company with 26,000 engineers in 30 different locations. And you never know who's going to have a bright idea. And that's just inside the company. Think of all the bright people that are outside, going back to the earlier panel about competitiveness. And by the way, I was born and raised in India. I came to this country on a student visa and then eventually got an H-1B and started as a line engineer and worked my way up now to lead all engineering for the company. So I think then you think about, one of my professors once said, intelligence is homogeneously distributed. Everybody in the world has a certain level of intelligence, and you never know where the first bright idea is going to come from. So I would argue that it's really not the CEO that drives innovation. It really has to be the environment and the culture in the company that allows people to be bold, like that person who had an idea, to stand up and say, hey, I have a bright idea, and I need to be given the freedom to go pursue this. What we did in Motorola is actually started a fund that is separate from our R&D investment that allows people inside and outside, even outside our company, to submit ideas that will help our strategic agenda. And if it's a good idea, we'll fund them. And it's like creating multiple startups. And you would think with 26,000 engineers in the company, there would be a large percentage of them that are entrepreneurial. Just because you work in a big company doesn't mean you check your brains outside the door. I mean, you're still thinking about how to solve problems. So how do we empower these people and give them the freedom to go pursue what they need to do? So I would argue that the leadership and the passion, it is actually at the bottom of the organization, and a leader's job is to allow that to breathe and allow that to foster.
I don't think we're disagreeing, but I think if you want that, but if you have a CEO who's passionate about it and who sets a tone, it makes a difference.
I think you guys are saying the same thing in different words. I actually think the CEO...
I like disagreement, so don't worry about it.
I think the CEO's job is to drive the culture, not the innovation. And I'm struck at how similar Toyota and Ernst & Younger. Your story, Diane, about any person being able to stop the production line. Part of the reason I travel like a madman, I'm leaving here and heading to Florida, then Paris and Tokyo before I ever get back, is because we have the exact same culture. And what we want our 120,000 people to know every day when they wake up is that nothing is more important than their own commitment to integrity and quality. Not the biggest client they work on, not the biggest one in their country. And that if something is making them feel uncomfortable, either at their client or, guess what, within Ernst & Young, it's not just okay for them to raise their hand, it's their job for them to raise their hand and stop the production line. And that's not a message you get, with all due respect to technology, that's not a message you get across to all these people by email or voicemail. It's a message you have to get cascaded personal eyeball to eyeball so people really believe it. And then you have to back it up and live it.
Well, there's a lot of ways you can get it across. Some companies do 360-degree evaluations. And, there's this great company in India, which I'm running a conference next week, and the CEO is speaking, HCL Technologies, where it's one of the big Indian outsourcing firms, where any employee in the company has the right to make a complaint about any subject, whether it's the food in the cafeteria or the way the management structure is set up. And the only person, and then a senior management person is assigned to every single one of those. And the only person who can determine if that question or problem has been resolved is the employee who originally put it into action. And they've really been, has become, as a result, one of the fastest growing companies in their industry, and they're really doing extremely well. But yeah, I wanted to add one more layer to this before we go to the audience. And it touches on something that Padmasree mentioned. And I think it's important if we're looking at all the forces that are driving companies to change in a way that benefits all society. And that is this issue of targeting the entire planet as the customer base, as opposed to simply the billion or so people in the developed world. And C.K. Prahalad has written this wonderful book, Fortune at the Bottom of the Pyramid, and became sort of the great spokesperson for this. But, you know, I don't, maybe Padmasree, you could talk about it a little bit because you have your $30 cell phone. And I personally believe that the companies that are doing the best right now are the ones who are focusing the most, especially among really large companies, on this opportunity. And talk a little bit about why that might be the case.
Sure. I think, you know, I talked a little bit about this yesterday in my session. If you look at what's happening to the technology industry, and I think you talked about the internet, and the internet has been a great tool for us, great resource for us in allowing the globe to be flatter and, you know, for us to all communicate. But the next phase of the internet is going to be internet that is mobile, you know, mobility added to the internet. Today, internet is fixed. You need a line and you need a computer and you plug into the Ethernet to get access to the internet. What if you could have the internet on your mobile phone when you're roaming anywhere, right? That's the ultimate need that people have, is we want freedom, we want to move around, and we want things that are important to go with us. Now, if you take that view and you say, okay, today half the planet is connected with mobile technology, there's still 3 billion people that are unconnected. How do you provide connectivity to them? A large percentage of them live in areas that where there is no infrastructure, and I mean no infrastructure in terms of electricity, roads, and other things. And so the only infrastructure that can connect them is wireless technology. And it's actually amazing. Roughly, the industry is growing at adding about 40 million subscribers every month. Half of the growth in developing countries is twice that in the developed markets. India and China account for a quarter of the growth that's coming from. India and China add roughly 6 million mobile subscribers every month. That's like connecting the entire country of Denmark in India and China alone, right, every month. So just this, the scale of it. And what these people are using these devices for is very different things than what people in developed countries use for. Yesterday, I told a story about how fishermen in Kerala, which is a small state in the southern part of India, now use mobile technology to find out the price of the fish while they're at sea. They call different coastal markets, find out what the price is, so it helps them decide where they sell their fish, which they otherwise couldn't do before because they didn't have any way of finding out. And here we take things like that for granted because the basic business premise is you set your pricing based on inventory, supply, and demand. Well, this poor fisherman had no means of finding out supply, demand, and inventory, so he couldn't set the price for his fish. So the mobile devices, in a way, is helping him run his business better. So it's become an economic tool. So because of all those factors, the growth is coming largely in our industry, and I would extend this to the internet, too, because the internet next has to go mobile. What is driving is actually the bottom of the pyramid. And so when we innovate or invent to satisfy the needs in this market, you can actually take the solutions upward, right? I mean, an example we give is we came up with a phone for the market in India that has very large buttons and large digits because a lot of people in India are not literate and they still want to communicate. And we went to an icon-based browser where you don't need to necessarily read the numbers or read the text, but there are images that help you make the phone calls that you need to make. And we changed the display so that it'll work in bright sunshine because India has a lot, you know, it's very sunny. And we launched the product, and we found actually that same technology we can deploy in the United States because a lot of people here, not because they're illiterate, but have vision impairment and could use icon-based or voice-activated even devices that would help them use it better. Same thing, the display that works in bright sunshine, how often do you take your cell phone and you're squinting in light, right? You don't need to do that anymore. So I think when you try to solve a problem that satisfies a big volume or large-scale, massive, geographically distributed, obviously there's a large percentage of that innovation you can reuse in developed markets.
That same thing's going to happen in the automobile business. Ratan
Absolutely.
Tata, as you know, is developing an automobile, you know, to sell across India for somewhere between $2,200 and $2,500 US dollars. And, you know, that technology However, it's not going to be a car like any of us ride around in, I'm quite certain. Absolutely. But it is going to influence the Toyotas and others all around the world.
Right, but when you can build something, the only way you can make something cheap enough for all those billions of people is to make it in huge volumes. But then once you make it in those volumes and you get it that cheap, everybody in the entire world is going
to
want it.
This is what Walmart does to the supply chains of the world.
I don't know that that's true that everyone wants it.
Say what?
I don't think that's true that everyone wants it. Fuel economy in the United States is averaging 24.1 miles per gallon. Fuel economy in the EU today is 37.2. And in Japan, it's 46.3. So the technology's there. It's what do you want to drive? What are people are making choices that are driving those decisions. So even if you make a car, you're right, that car that's made in India, we couldn't probably sell it in the United States.
Oh, I agree. But my point is some of the technology.
Legally.
Unless somebody forces you to, right?
No,
unless
someone sell legally. Some of the technology
is
legal.
But I still don't know how to force people to buy it. Yeah. That's the part.
I'm as interested in how the technology that it will be, you know, and the materials that will be used to drive the construction of that at a low price point, how that will also bleed over and impact the technology of Toyota and the others. Not just, you know, the further markets of a $2,500 car.
Anybody have a question, comment from the audience? Okay, you're right by the mic, so go ahead and be first.
I think it was Mr. Doc that said that, can't hear me? Can you hear me? That your greatest contribution is what you're good at. And obviously you guys are amazing at innovation. I'm very involved in Washington, D.C., but this is a worldwide organization that teaches entrepreneurship to inner city youth. And I was just curious what you feel your role as corporations are in giving back to that innovation for the next generation. Love to hear from all of you.
I'd be happy to start. One of my responsibilities at Walmart is to manage our foundation, and we donate $240 million a year in cash. It's the largest corporate cash foundation in the world, and we give most of that back, in a sense, in the communities in which we operate. And I think for us, we take a very strong obligation to give back to the communities, and we also take a very strong obligation to do that. But I think, to your point, the same thing, when we look at how to manage the foundation, I try and make these choices about what we're going to be about, I still try and go back to what we're good at, because I think we can leverage that. So, for example, when we look at how we can make a difference in economic opportunity, we try and look at the people who try and work in our stores. We opened a store in Chicago. It was quite controversial. Opened a few months ago, we had 15,000 people apply for 400 jobs. Now, a lot of people say that a Walmart job is, you know, not at the top of the economic ladder. But for those 15,000 people, it was clearly a step up from where they were. And so, what we're trying to do now is to say, okay, how do we go back to those 14,600 people who waited in line or applied on the internet but couldn't get a job with us? And how do we go back and teach them the skills that they may need to get a job somewhere else? And so I think even there, just as strategically, and it may not be the right answer, but strategically I think we can still make the most benefit even with our philanthropic dollars if we put it close to the communities in which we operate and something that we know something about.
I think there's another aspect to that. We also have a foundation that does, you know, many of those things that are very similar. But I think there's another important aspect to the point that you talked about, and that is contribution of time and expertise. I think companies obviously do a lot by giving money, foundation grants and corporation grants, et cetera. But we also allow our employees to contribute several days in a year, and we assign those days to global service days, where people volunteer their expertise to go teach in schools, and we focus primarily in science and technology because that is important for us in K-12 education, teaching entrepreneurship in different chamber of commerce types of organizations and small communities. I think that's a very important aspect of it because there's so much experience in companies, right, that people have to, you know, you have to mentor younger people to be thinking about that, get them excited about careers in science and technology, and then project it as it's a cool industry to be in and it's a cool field to get into. So I'm very passionate about this. I personally devote my time to go
She's
and
very
talk
cool.
to women and young girls about this. And somebody asked this question in the previous session. She was right on. I think I was educated in India, and you know and I grew up there. And when you're growing to school, children aspire to be scientists, technologists, engineers. And I find it very sad that in this country we don't have the same kind of passion instilled. So I think it's very important that companies and their employees contribute their time and expertise as well.
Hi, I have two questions. First, how do you inspire employees just kind of at the basic level, entry level, to become leaders and also be innovative? And then also, how do you reconcile having innovation and also being socially responsible when media criticism says that a lot of your companies can't meet the basic needs of your kind of entry-level employees?
I can talk to that. I think there's many ways.
I guess so.
Sorry?
You go ahead, and then we'll have to
let Les gets the second half of that question.
I was looking to see.
You have to let Les.
Okay. I think how do you motivate employees that are entry-level to take leadership? I think somebody said this. I mean, I personally believe that leaders exist in all parts of the organization at all levels. It doesn't just come with a position and a title. So I think the thing to do is to allow people to inherently allow that leadership to come forward in people at all levels, right? And so I do many things, and leaders in my organization do many things, such as chat sessions and informal coffee sessions where people can come into my office, entry level all the way up, and we talk about, you know, what are the challenges. Then we have formal programs like mentoring programs and job shadow programs where they can follow other leaders and think, you know, not a lot of them want a lot of responsibility either, because it's not just all fun. There's a lot of stress that comes with it. So they can kind of see all aspects of the job and figure out what their career path should be. And then I think you wanted to answer the second part.
Let me add something to the first part, because you're absolutely, it's all about, for me, engaging with people. And if the people in, quote, the title leadership roles are actually engaged with the people at all levels, then it does more than you could possibly imagine to encourage leadership, personal leadership of all the people, and encourage engagement. Oftentimes,
nothing is more alienating than when it's not the case.
Absolutely right.
Very common that is happening.
And frankly, well, it is common, but also nothing is easier to do and more fun to do than to be with, you know, our people around the world and to be with our clients as well. But when you are just there, I get energy from our people. It doesn't drain me at all. It lifts me. And I'm told that also when you know, Beth Brooks here, one of our leaders, we have lots of leaders in our firm, all they need to do is the little things. You know, asking someone how they're doing, thanking someone for what they've done. This level of personal engagement really helps drive a teaming culture. And when you've got a teaming culture, it really does support and motivate and help retain and grow people. I think that you can't have, you know, sort of an ivory tower mentality and have the kind of personal engagement at the ground level.
I agree with everything that's been said, and I think, you know, even you learn a business like ours with 1.9 million people, you try and think what you could do during the day that's going to make a difference in a business that size if you're theoretically partially responsible for running it. And the single best thing you can do is to hire the right people and motivate them to do the job, because that's what you can touch. So I think it's critical, and it's much more fun for all of us to go visit a store and talk to the people who work for us and the customer than it usually is, you know, to be in the office and talk to reporters. So we know that for sure. So
interesting though reporters can be.
Yeah, as interesting as they can be. So but I think that, you know, on the second half of the question, I mean, I think, you know, we're an interesting employer that way, and for many of our entry-level employees, it's their first job, and we hope it's a ladder of opportunity, and 70% of our managers started as hourly employees, and, you know, if you run a Walmart store, you're running a $150 million business, and you may have usually started off pushing carts, and so it's an interesting, you know, you've got a huge amount of responsibility, a fairly, you know, it kind of a middle-level management for us. But in sustainability, for example, what we've done is we went out and hired a great guy named Adam Werbach. He was once the president of the Sierra Club, and together with him, we've started something called personal sustainability projects. And we take those out to the stores, and we now have about 450,000 of our U.S. Employees, our U.S. associates, who we've enabled to take on personal sustainability projects of their own. And they're sometimes either in have to do with their own sort of, like, I'm going to eat healthier, I'm going to walk to work, and some of them are in the environment. But we've made this very conscious effort in sustainability to really bring it down onto the floor level of the stores. And it's been a great thing for those folks, because they felt that they've improved their own lives, and they've made a difference to the company. We had like your story, at one of these quarterly sustainability meetings that we have, we brought in a woman who was one of the first people to do a personal sustainability project at Sam's, which is our kind of Costco-like enterprise. And she stood up and she said, you know, this has been a great thing for me, but what I don't understand is that at the Sam's Cafeteria, where I have lunch, or where the customers have lunch, that it costs me twice as much to buy a salad as it does to buy a hot dog. And how do you expect us to do this if we don't, you know, you don't charge the same thing for salad at the cafeteria? So one, you know, and so the next day we reduced the price of the salad. So by involving people in that way and letting them see results, I think you can really get a lot of you get a lot of enthusiasm out of your
people. I have to just say, as an individual, I'm frustrated by some of the things I read when Walmart's being criticized. I can only imagine what it feels like from your perspective, because just think about, you know, oftentimes you are portrayed as being just an awful place to work. And think about what you just said earlier, 15,000 people applying for 400 jobs. There's some real disconnect between what's happening on the ground in very, very positive ways and the vast majority of the stories.
Well, there's something so unique.
There's a better PR person, I think. Yeah. Well,
Walmart is so unique in its scale that there's really a lot of issues that apply to it that really don't apply to any other company. Like, for example, you were telling me that your $4 prescription thing, you know, they now offer generic drugs for $4, and they're making money doing it because they have so much buying power. You know, and what you said, you'd save 336.
Saved our customer $350 million in 6 months from what they would have paid for the same drug.
So you may not
November.
Give your employees the health care that some people would like you to do, but then you're allowing them and anybody else who wants to buy drugs at your store to get health care for less. So that's sort of complex.
And we do have 90% of our associates have health insurance. So.
Good. We'll make it 100.
We are trying. We're trying.
But anyway, go ahead.
No, they'll still be criticized. Trust me.
Change topic, back to the policy and the question of climate change, which has been talked about in so many rooms in the Aspen Ideas Festival. You were talking a second bit about fuel economy, and I guess the question I have, if I take on face value Tom Friedman's challenge the other day, that this is simply a problem of such extraordinary dimensions that it cannot move forward without a significant policy intervention. We simply have to have, and you referenced it in the fuel economy, we simply have to have a stronger statement coming in the policy sphere. So the question I have is, given the incredible capacity that business has to influence policy within industries and for the specific purposes of the firm, how do we actually, like, and I'll try to pose it in a way of saying, what would it take the CEOs of your organizations, in your case, Jim, I don't know if you want to talk about personally or think about the firms that you advise, to really step up and say we need to create a new rank of business focus in Washington on this? Because I don't see it happening without that. I'm kind of curious within your firms.
You mean specifically on fuel economy and green issues or?
Specifically on climate.
You know, I think you're right. I mean, I think whether it be healthcare, whether it be, you know, the environment, there's going to be a government role in this, you know, because there just has to be. And so I think the difficulty in corporations is to really look at the issues that are core to your business that you're going to participate in, and when do you participate strongly on a policy matter that actually is not core to making your business stronger. So, you know, for us, we've teamed in healthcare, we've teamed up with the communications workers and SEIU and AT&T and now 18 or 19 other companies to go out there and kind of lobby for systematic healthcare reform. You know, we've been criticized for that. I was criticized for it on this stage sitting here yesterday. But, you know, at the same time, we think it's the right thing to do. You know, on climate change, we, for example, are looking at have been part of the conversation about something called US CAP, which you may know about, which I happen to be on the board of WRI, and WRI World Resources has been a leader in that. And I think, you know, a number of companies have stepped up to participate in that. It's something that Walmart's looking at. And I think, you know, as companies, there will be a select number of issues that companies will need to step up on and participate. And then I think I would ask, you know, as an employee, in a sense, that people also respect and have the patience to know that you can't do that on very many things. You cannot sort of, you know, you can't lobby on all the things that you care about or all the things where people think you need to play a role. That you need to be selective, and you need to pick the big ones, but then you need to step up.
I think from our point of view, we see that the government really has to step in. The issues are too big. But the problem is, quite frankly, that it's very difficult to energize the government around politically unpalatable solutions. I mean, why are people in Japan and Europe making arguably better climate choices? Because the fuel is so expensive, they can't afford to do otherwise. And raising fuel taxes is not something that you want that anybody wants Congress to do in this country, apparently.
Tom Friedman wants them to do that.
Well, that's true. That's true. And there's a whole lot of argument about if you had raised fuel prices, the government have that money instead of the oil companies. But I do think that we have a system where we really have a need for leadership around these policy issues, and only the government can balance the complicated formulas. We've heard a lot about that, you know, all we have to do is use up all our corn or our soybeans or whatever and get nothing is that simple. There is no silver bullet here. There are going to have to be some hard choices, and people are going to have to do things that they don't necessarily want to do. And only the government can tell us that that's going to have to happen. But we aren't seeing that kind of leadership. And as a corporation, I don't know how you get that kind of leadership out of government.
You know, you've asked, it's a very insightful question. I'm trying to figure out, because I think you're right, I think government action is going to be necessary. It is unclear to me what the barriers are. Part of it, what's running around in my head, is that it's not a single government problem. It's a, you know, there's, you know, a lot of governments around the world that are wrestling with the same issue. And I can tell you, we think we're doing a lot of really good things, but we're not going out saying this is our most important issue, to your point, less in terms of legislating. What we are doing is staying close to what, you know, our talent is, which is around education, financial literacy, governance, and other issues. But it's a great question that we'll have to think some more about. Because I think you're right. I think if the business roundtable were to pound the table and say to the U.S. government, do something, or be more specific and say, do X, Y, and Z, then maybe that would help get things moving.
Well, that has sort of been happening on education without a whole lot of impact, I have to say. Yeah.
Can I just correct one thing? I'm not saying Toyota's in favor of raising fuel taxes.
Right.
I'm just illustrating that as how you get the, how is one way you have.
Well, what about much higher CAFE standards?
Toyota is in favor of higher CAFE standards.
You are?
Yes.
Higher even than the ones that were recently enacted?
We haven't taken a position on how high is high. But we're, our only position is it needs to be federal. It can't be state by state. And it needs to be decided by people who are capable of balancing all of the issues.
What was your lobbying position on the bill that was recently passed?
The bill that was, you mean the one in the Senate?
Yeah.
We do not lobby directly on those issues. The trade associations
were split. So you
didn't oppose
it, or I'm sorry.
We are the only company who belongs to two trade associations, because we have such a large U.S. presence. We're part of the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers, and we are also part of the Import Association.
But the Alliance strongly.
The Alliance opposed much of the issues, although not on rate. They are in favor of raising CAFE.
Yeah, but
and they're in favor of NHTSA deciding
by
it.
By an amount that Tom Friedman thinks is trivially small. That's another.
Right. Of course, I'm not taking responsibility
for
that either.
We're not criticizing Toyota for this, by the way.
Yeah, I have a question. My name is Pete Thigpen. I was in the last session, which was on U.S. competitiveness, and probably north of 50% of the conversation was about the U.S. educational system. And rather than putting pressure on the government, I'd like to ask the four of you, and your considerable resources, considerable brain power, if all of a sudden you pooled your resources and you bought out the U.S. educational system, what are the first two or three things you would do to fix it?
In 30 words or less.
30 words or less, I would probably say put a lot of choice into the system so that the parents got to choose where their sons or daughters went to school. And through that, put more, if you will, market-based competition into it. And I would probably, I'm with 25 words, I would probably rethink whether or not issues of religious-based education are as, you know, the devil as some make it sound. It seems to be okay in some universities. And so I'd look at that again, too.
Real quickly.
I know enough about this subject to have even a 30-word intelligent answer.
Wow. You should.
But I'm assuming it's K through 12, so because we are fairly, I think U.S. is very competitive in advanced education, so I'm going to talk about K through 12. 30 words or less. First, I would pay teachers a lot more. I would raise the level of selection for teachers. Most school teachers should have an advanced degree in the domain that they're teaching. If they're science teachers, they should have master's degrees, PhDs, etc. I would make sure that all schools, regardless of whether they're private or public, have basic resources like computer labs and internet access and broadband capability. Those are the three things I would do right away.
And I would be speaking only for myself, because I don't think the company has a position on this. But my own personal view is
that was, by the way, not my company.
Yes, okay. We're all speaking for ourselves.
That was my personal view.
And the press is not here.
I think my suggestions come from my belief that the American education system, this is an odd view, I guess, it began to go in the wrong direction when women got other choices. When I first started in college, everybody I knew wanted to be a teacher, because that was the best option for you. So we had a lot of incredibly, the best and the brightest of women were teaching our children every day. And then women in the 60s, and I was part of them, got a lot more choices. And you'd say, gee, I could do that, but gee, I could go to law school, or I could go to medical school, or I could go to business school, and I could do other things, and I could make a lot more money, and if I'm going to get, and somebody's going to divorce me, then maybe I need that money. So I think that there, I go back to the same notion. You have to pay people what you deserve. We value what we pay,
so you're not saying women
don't
should
pay.
Have less choices, right?
Pardon?
You're not saying women should have less
choices. No, I don't think so. But I think the way you get women to choose, the way you get women and other people to choose to be really good teachers is to value it in our society and to say, how are we telling our children that education is important when we pay our teachers pitifully? It's outrageous. And you get what you pay for in this country.
Interestingly, even the private schools pay pitifully. But for some reason,
but they get the truly devoted, you know, idealistic, because then they can do what they want to do.
They get better teachers in many cases, not always. Cameron.
Hi, I'm Cameron Sinclair. Actually, just to go back on the last question, I was at a conference last week, exactly the same question, but why don't your corporations buy hospitals and start your own healthcare, which I thought was kind of interesting. And As a new father, I would want my child in a Toyota school because it would be in a green, sustainable, zero footprint school, no doubt. My question is that all of you are global companies, and you talk very highly about the incentives you're doing in terms of protecting the environment here and doing financial literacy here. I'd like to hear from each of you what you're doing as you're entering developing nations and developing markets within those nations in doing financial literacy, in raising the bar of environmental standards, even if it's in opposition to the government position.
But make it a little simpler question if you want all four of them to answer, because we're having to make this the last question anyway.
Okay.
And summarize what you want them to talk about. Really,
what I want them to say. Just that, what is your philanthropic movements in these new developing markets that you're taking advantage of?
I'm happy to answer that but first on the sustainability piece. We've done this in a handful of ways. One, all of our companies have to adhere to something we call global innovation projects. They all have metrics on improving the energy efficiency of their stores, reducing their waste, improving recycling, and improving products. So each of the countries in which we operate has a set of metrics they have to meet on sustainability. Secondly, what we're trying to do very hard, and one of the things I'm responsible for at the company, for example, is our sustainability policy in China. Take that as an example. And so we are working very hard to understand what we can do in the supply chain in China to green that supply chain. And so I was just there recently. We're meeting with Chinese and U.S. NGOs, with the government, with our suppliers, to, again, find the sweet spot that I was talking about before. How do we take what we do well, the leverage that we have in the supply system, going in a developing country where there's actually very little knowledge about who pollutes and who doesn't pollute and very little enforcement, and see what our best role is as Walmart to sort of green that supply chain. And that's the same kind of posture we're trying to take in a lot of the developing countries in which we work.
Real quickly, anybody else?
So three things we do. First thing is Motorola has a foundation, and the foundation makes a lot of contributions, monetary contributions, philanthropic contributions to many of the schools to educate the students, because at some point in time they'll be in our workforce. So we start kind of there, and we do a lot of work globally. By the way, half our revenues come from outside of the U.S., half our employee base is outside the U.S. The second thing we do is, as I talked about, we encourage all our employees to be involved with the community that they're part of. So in India, for example, we have people that go and teach in schools in the slums. And we do that through the technology that we have. So we deploy Motorola's wireless broadband technologies to provide internet access, and we go and teach this, the teachers and the students how to use the internet once it's there. So those are the kinds of things we do. The third thing we do is innovating to protect the environment. And I talked about the solar energy, wind energy. How do you use the resources that exist in many of these emerging markets to create solutions rather than force the solutions that we've developed for advanced markets to fit in developing markets?
And I don't know a whole lot about our outside the United States efforts, but I do know the Earth Charter obligations are imposed on every Toyota entity worldwide so that everybody has metrics they have to meet and issues they have to confront. So I can't speak specifically.
I'll be very quick. The things we talked about, financial literacy, mentoring, governance, transparency, and entrepreneurship are global focuses. So same in India, same in Russia, same in U.S.
Yeah, they need it. Well, thank you so much. Great panel, really interesting discussion. Thank you all.
Great.